This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. My guest today is Zoltan Grossman, professor of geography and native studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. Zoltan is a longtime community organizer. He is co-editor of Asserting Native Resilience, Pacific Rim Indigenous Nations Face the Climate Crisis. Zoltan Grossman is here to tell us about his most recent book, Unlikely Alliances, Native Nations and White Communities Join to Defend Rural Lands, published in 2017. Welcome, Zoltan.
Well, thank you.
Why did you write Unlikely Alliances? What is your purpose?
Well, I had been involved in a number of environmental alliances, peripherally in South Dakota when I was basically a teenager, working with an amazing group called the Black Hills Alliance, which was trying to protect and successfully did protect the Black Hills from coal and uranium mining. The hills are considered sacred by the Lakota people. And this was only 6 or 7 years after a major clash at Wounded Knee. And yet the Lakota came together not only with some local environmentalists, but also with white ranchers. And I was just amazed to see the cowboys and Indians come together because they're the archetypal enemies in American history. And to see the people of the land feel that they have some kind of commonality with each other was really inspiring and encouraging. Then I was living in Wisconsin at the time when there was a major treaty rights war over fishing that was guaranteed by treaties, very similar to what happened here in the Pacific Northwest in the 60s and 70s, but this was in the late 80s and early 90s, where the Ojibwe, it was recognized by the courts that they had retained the right to hunt, fish, and gather in northern Wisconsin, and they were met with mobs of white sportsmen who were throwing rocks and bottles, and there was sniper fires, basically a little civil war in northern Wisconsin. And yet, this seeming miracle happened that when mining companies were coming into that ceded territory in northern Wisconsin, some, not the leadership, but some of the followers of the anti-treaty groups began to have conversations with the tribal members and tribal leaders and realized that the same treaties that they were opposing were in fact the best legal protection for the same fish that they had fought over. So instead of fighting over the fish, they came together to kick out the mining companies from northern Wisconsin. And now here in the Pacific Northwest, we have similar kinds of alliances against the oil and coal terminals and oil and coal trains that are coming into this region that bring together the Quinault, Swinomish, Lummi, with some of the crabbers, the oyster people who previously had been adversaries to both the tribes and environmentalists. Back in the treaty wars in the Pacific Northwest, you have this recurring pattern of out of these treaty rights or sovereignty struggles that pit native and white neighbors against each other, you have this amazing convergence when those same resources, water, fish, land, are endangered by outside interests. And I became more interested in the alliances themselves than over the issues that they were actually fighting about. And so especially in this era where the two types of politics, unity politics, appealing to universal values of economic equality or the environment, are often counterposed to particularist or identity politics that assert the rights of particular groups based on culture, race, gender, and the two are always seen somehow in contradiction to each other, that you can't have both unity around common issues and the assertion of rights that have been denied by groups like Native Americans, Native Nations. And I found through my research and also just through working with people that, in fact, there isn't necessarily a contradiction, that something like the assertion of treaty rights by Native Americans can, in fact, protect the resources not only for indigenous communities, but for everybody. And that was a real revelation that really drove me to write the book, especially in this era after the Trump election.
What geographical areas and types of alliances have you included in your book?
I've lived as an adult kind of between the Great Lakes and the Pacific Northwest. So really looking at Wisconsin, the Dakotas, Montana, Washington, Oregon, and also kind of through in Nevada, because one of the earliest And most interesting alliances was against the MX missile system back in the late 70s that brought together Western Shoshone, Southern Paiute, some of the white ranchers, environmentalists, anti-nuke people. And so I was really intrigued by some of these alliances, be they around mines or against hydroelectric dams or against military bombing ranges or test ranges. It really didn't matter what the particular environmental threat was. I was really interested in how these adversaries really came together, and not only came together in a common defense of the landscape, which I was really interested in as a geographer, this common sense of place that they had, even though they had a different sense of place, it was still valuing that local watershed or that local mountain range, but how they learned from each other in the process of creating the alliance. So when either they lost or won on the particular environmental issue, they had learned a lot about each other's histories, about each other's cultures. You had some of the white ranchers and farmers that for the first time knew that there were sacred burial sites on their lands and gave tribal members access to both have ceremonies and protect those sites. So a larger sense of learning and convergence that came out of this kind of short-term self-interest of protecting the land together.
Who did you interview in the research for your book?
I interviewed about 120 people over the space of a number of years, about half of them Native, about half of them non-Native, about a third of them women, because even though the image of cowboys and white sport fishers is predominantly male, a lot of the leadership has been women throughout. And these are people who are either in the leadership of some of these grassroots environmental groups. We'd meet across their kitchen tables. Some of them were elected tribal leaders. Some of them were local government leaders. And I was really interested in that interplay between tribal governments and local governments that are often at odds over jurisdiction, over taxation, resources, but that they would often work together in the context of protecting their local watershed. And I think some of the, just the activists who were involved in these issues to kind of get their stories out, because there would be a lot of documentation of the issue that they were working on and how polluting the potential mine might be or the effects of low-level jet flights. But there wasn't much documentation on how they had come together and how their conversations and their breakthroughs happened in the course of the early stages of these alliances. So one of the reasons I wrote the book was really for those elsewhere in the country who are beginning to build those bridges between the communities. And sometimes the most important people are the people who have some prior relationship, either through family or through their job, that brings them together with the other community. And they would be the people who would be the most important in the early stages of the alliances. So I was kind of writing this book partly to get conversations going about particularism and universalism, identity politics and unity politics, but also really to provide some precedents to people who might want to form such an alliance.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Zoltan Grossman, professor of geography and Native studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and author of the book, Unlikely Alliances, Native Nations and White Communities Join to Defend Rural Lands. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. Would you say more about the role that the recognition and use of Native Nation treaty rights has played in the success of alliances?
Sure. In Wisconsin, as an example, the treaties that the indigenous nations signed with the United States in the 1840s, 1850s in the Great Lakes region and the Pacific Northwest, they didn't include mineral rights. They included the rights to hunt, fish, and gather. But in certain federal court cases, the tribes have had standing because of those treaties to challenge what they would see as environmental violations of those rights. So the courts may, as in the case of the Bolt decision in Washington State in 1974, recognize that the tribes retain, they keep the rights to hunt, fish, and gather that were guaranteed them under the treaties. But what if a hydroelectric dam or strip logging or agricultural development, what if that pollutes or erodes the landscape and the streams so much that the fish aren't there anymore? And in the culverts case, in particular in Washington, the tribes have won a federal court order to protect the salmon habitat from damage. In Wisconsin, they used their treaty rights and sovereignty as a way to enter the arena of public relations, but also to get the federal courts and federal agencies on their side and trying to reverse some of the damage from existing mines or other threats to the environment, or to prevent certain projects from damaging the fishery. And so it's, in a sense, using the treaties as a tool, but the treaties also have a history of sparking a cultural renaissance in the tribes. And that has been a really key element in mobilizing tribal members in these battles to protect the land and water, but also has been inspiring to non-Native people to see that there's a different way of relating to the land rather than simply as economic extraction, and to value the deep history that the indigenous nations have in that territory, which is very much deeper than the white ranchers or fishers or farmers. But nevertheless, a lot of the rural white population also feels this deep attachment and feel very much that their lifestyles are threatened when an outside entity like a mining company or a government agency comes in and proposes a project that they know would be damaging to their future on the land.
How have treaty rights played a role in resistance to oil and coal infrastructure in the Pacific Northwest?
You can kind of play a mind game. If the Bolt decision in 1974 had not been for the tribes and recognizing that they retained their rights but had gone against the tribes, I feel that the environment in the Pacific Northwest, especially the salmon fishery, would be much more damaged than it already is. In 1989, the Centennial Accord between the state and the tribes kind of enshrined a relationship that guaranteed the tribes a seat at the table when it came to fisheries allocation. The tribes have used that seat very much to argue for protecting the fishery, not only from oil and coal, but also from the effects of oil and coal in climate change. And so you have tribes such as Lummi, such as Quinault, such as Swinomish, that have been at the forefront of opposing new oil terminals that would bring in Bakken oil, exploding trains from North Dakota that would bring in coal from the Powder River Basin, where the Northern Cheyenne tribe is actually also opposing coal mines, and kind of taking the lead in these alliances in the sense that they're the people with the longest tenure on the land at the mouths of these rivers. They have not only economic interests in the fishery, but cultural interests. There are burial sites as well in some of these places like Cherry Point. And so the treaties give them, or not give them, but they have kept a government-to-government relationship with the federal government that enables, for instance, the Army Corps of Engineers to have a finding last year that the Cherry Point coal terminal would violate Lummi treaty rights. That was unprecedented and was looked at all over the country. The Quinault Nation is opposing a Bakken oil terminal at Grace Harbor in Aberdeen and Hoquiams. Many of the crabbers, the oyster people, the fishermen have been joining with the Quinault, who previously they had been adversaries overfishing, and providing a very strong local alliance that's actually even stronger than having, let's say, urban-based mainstream environmental groups, which don't have much of a following in places like Aberdeen and Hoquiam that had gone through the Spotted Owl Wars. To have these local relationships with the people of the land of the ocean is, in fact, an even stronger place-based resistance than simply the traditional kind of Sierra Club type of environmental groups coming in from the outside. These are local people, and they can't be as stereotyped as just yuppies or hippies that don't care about rural jobs. These are people who care about rural jobs. They don't want jobs in fossil fuels. They want jobs that are sustainable.
What did you observe about the importance of equality or groups being on an equal footing and forming successful alliances?
It's a process of equalization that takes place, not only the kind of legal equalization that, let's say, the recognition of treaty rights brings or the assertion of sovereignty. There's also the cultural interplay of a strong assertion of culture. There's also an economic process of equalization in some of these case studies, such as in Wisconsin and Washington, where casinos did enable the tribes to fund some of these efforts to protect the land and water. But in other places like Montana, South Dakota, certainly Nevada, tribes really don't have that economic power. But you can have an alliance, you can have unity, but it may be challenged by wedge issues. It may be challenged, an example being in southern Wisconsin, Ho-Chunk territory, where there was a very strong alliance against low-level jet flights that would be detrimental to the health of cattle, of horses. So you had dairy farmers and the Amish and the Ho-Chunk indigenous nation and environmentalists joining together. But then the demands of the white members of the alliance were met by the Air National Guard, and the demands against the expansion of a particular bombing range that was primarily led by the Ho-Chunk nation was not met by the National Guard. And so you had basically a split, a divide and conquer strategy, where the white members of the alliance celebrated their victory and basically sold out their native allies. And so you can have an alliance, but unity isn't enough. There really has to be an element of understanding that an alliance means that everybody carries forward each other's issues in solidarity, and it stops being simply in self-interest and starts being in terms of having this long-term relationship into the future. And so you can't have an alliance of unequal partners. That's not unity. Unity is trying to lift everyone up together.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Zoltan Grossman, professor of geography and native studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and author of the book Unlikely Alliances, Native Nations and White Communities Join to Defend Rural Lands. How do efforts to form alliances from the top down compare to grassroots efforts from the bottom up?
Yeah, there are certainly things to be said about the government-to-government relationship. Tribal nations need that government-to-government relationship with the federal government, primarily to protect themselves against local and state governments that want to run roughshod over their territory, over their natural wealth. But government-to-government relationships only go so far. And they're at the top of society. They tend to be top down. They can create resentment at the base in both communities that feel left out of some of these discussions. There are other examples of alliances where there's no government to government cooperation at all. And the relationship is more people to people at the community level. It's cultural. It's based on very intimate local relationships. And those can be successful as well. In Wisconsin, those kind of alliances have run some of the world's largest mining companies out of the state. But they can also be frustrated and sabotaged from the top by ambitious politicians, by government agencies. And that's happened in places like the Klamath Basin. We had a very strong people-to-people relationship, but the political leadership wasn't going along with it, and the non-Native community. And so I think the strongest relationships are those that are both government to government and people to people on parallel tracks. We're starting to see that in some places in Washington state, where the tribes have a relatively strong relationship with the state and federal governments, and you have the beginnings of these kind of local watershed-based relationships. I think one of the best examples is the Nisqually watershed, where the Nisqually tribe is recognized as lead entity in plans for salmon habitat restoration. And you have farmers along the Nisqually very encouraged and very excited about working with the tribe in order to protect the salmon. You also have elsewhere in the country the very strong alliance against the Keystone XL pipeline by the Cowboy Indian Alliance that formed in 2013 and within a couple of years convinced President Obama to cancel that northern leg of the Keystone XL oil pipeline. But of course, President Trump is trying to push it through again. South Dakota and Nebraska are very much red states, and you have very conservative ranchers and farmers joining together with Lakota, with other tribal members, and trying to bring some of their leadership along. And so that's a good example of an alliance from below that has been very successful in moving governments in their direction.
What are the key challenges in trying to build successful alliances?
Well, I think there are some areas of the country where such alliances really aren't possible because your rural white population is primarily not only opposing native rights, but is opposing environmental integrity or doesn't believe in climate change, for instance. So I think that kind of grassroots education needs to take place in a lot of parts of the country. But where there are the ingredients for an alliance, where there's a common sense of place, a common sense of purpose, a common enemy, a common sense of understanding, I think the challenge isn't necessarily so much in forming the alliance, but keeping it going beyond the immediate environmental threat and having the opportunity for kind of social interaction. So in northern Wisconsin, there was a very successful alliance against a proposed iron mine in 2011 through 2015 in a state that's been very much dominated by the new Republican governor, Scott Walker, who has won victory over victory, but wasn't able to crack this alliance of the Bad River Ojibwe tribe and its white neighbors. And part of the reason they came together was they had potlucks with each other. They had fish fries, which is a mainstay of Wisconsin culture. They sat down and discussed the treaties. They discussed possible economic alternatives to mining. They discussed how much they loved Lake Superior. And so they came out of this alliance with a much stronger understanding of each other and with the non-Native people having an understanding of Native culture. That's the real challenge in an alliance. One of my interviewees in South Dakota put it very well. Sometimes you take two steps forward in forming an alliance and then you take one step back. But the next alliance is much easier to form that takes another two steps forward and maybe another one step back. And so you see in places like South Dakota that have a very racist history and a lot of still contention over many, many issues between Native and non-Native communities, you see a gradual improvement in those relationships and a gradual shift in power relations.
Would you underscore the conditions that allow successful alliances to come forward?
Yeah, I kind of began to see the pattern of three common senses. First was a common sense of place, the love that people had for a particular riverway like the Wolf River in Wisconsin or the Tongue River in Montana, the proximity of a particular environmental threat to particular communities, and kind of the cultural education that took place about the history of the land, both the love of the land and also the previous dispossession of the land, and how, in fact, some of the efforts at removal of non-Native people from the land through eminent domain, through removal in order to have a dam flood a particular area, for instance, closely paralleled what happened to Native people before, 100 years ago, by those same families. And so this kind of common understanding of that history of that place. The second is a common sense of purpose, which is having a particular outside corporation or outside government agency providing, in a sense, a threat to this particular region that not only provides a rallying point for the people, but begins to redefine them instead of seeing each other as simply the outsiders. And some of the chants of the anti-treaty movement in Wisconsin, "Indians go home," which was always one of my favorites. That's pretty difficult for Indians to go home. But what they meant is go home to the reservation. We don't want you outside the reservation, or white man's land. That was one of the racist chants that was used. So this definition of each other as outsiders was recast, and people began to see each other as insiders in a common home of a particular, the Wolf River watershed, the Black Hills, the Salish Sea, and the Umatilla Basin, places that are at a human scale, not giant areas, but places that are at a more human scale. And the third was a common sense of understanding. And that is in the course of some of these treaty conflicts, some of which turned quite violent, there was an effort by some of the leadership to say, look, we need to have discussions over anything we have in common in order to prevent someone from getting killed. And so you would have coming out of conflict these projects of reconciliation, not from the state, but in these local communities that led to an emphasis on some of these alliances. And what I found really interesting and consistent across the country is some of the native activists who are the most adamant about treaty rights, most adamant about protecting their sovereignty, their particularism, their identity politics, were exactly the same leaders who were the most open to alliances with their non-native neighbors. They saw a commonality. Walt Brissett, who was a Red Cliff Ojibwe activist who was instrumental in the anti-mining alliances, said, "We actually have more things in common with the anti-Indian people than we do with the state of Wisconsin or the mining corporations." And so what I found fascinating was that in some of the areas that had the most intense conflicts over treaty rights were some of the same places where it was easiest to form environmental alliances, and those environmental alliances were more successful than in areas where the tribes maybe held back in fear of alienating their white neighbors. It's exactly the opposite of what you'd think. You'd think that the places where the conflict wasn't as intense, it would be easier to build that bridge with the non-native community. But in fact, it seemed very consistent to be in those places where the conflict was most intense. And what I concluded is that the conflict over treaty rights educated the non-native community about the tribes' continuing political and legal powers, that those didn't somehow disappear in the 20th and 21st centuries, that the tribes still retained very much of a cultural resilience, that that wasn't something that was just in the past. Just because someone is driving pickup trucks doesn't mean that they don't attend ceremonies. And there was also recognition that the two groups, the rural whites and the native people who are the ones battling over the place, were the only ones who really cared about it. The rest of society really didn't care if their rural-based lifestyle would continue into the future. They saw their kids moving for jobs in the city. They would see corporate chains moving in and displacing small businesses. And so the sense of kind of this local-scale, cross-cultural populism really came out of some of these conflicts. And they found out that they actually had quite a bit in common that they never would have found had there not been the assertion of treaty rights and sovereignty by the tribes.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think, again, returning to one of the themes of the book is that I think, especially since the Trump election, there's been this automatic assumption that somehow for groups that are based on race, culture, ethnicity, gender, to assert their identity is not detrimental to building a unified movement around common universal ideas of, for instance, economic equality or environmental protection, but in fact can, in the right conditions, enhance and even deepen those kind of relationships built on basically unity and diversity. And so that we don't have this assumption or needing to shut down discussions like Black Lives Matter or Native Treaty Rights at Standing Rock, because in a way that those movements push the envelope not only for their own community, but for rights and for a better world for everyone in society.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Zoldan.
Thank you.
You were just listening to Zoldan Grossman, professor of geography and Native studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and author of the book Unlikely Alliances, Native Nations and White Communities Join to Defend Rural Lands, published in 2017 by the University of Washington Press. For more information, check on the web at sites.evergreen.edu/unlikely alliances. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and at kexp.org.